This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland. Monday marks the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, the day protesters set up camp in Zuccotti Park in New York. Throughout the fall, camps sprang up around the country. Twitter and Facebook were abuzz. Local TV news did live shots from tents. But the demonstrators were eventually evicted. And now the question is what that whole effort actually accomplished. But before we get to that question, let's hear from some of the folks who participated in the Occupy movement through some letters they wrote to financial institutions.
We will create change because we're not just disaffected hippies. We're the disaffected middle class. And we're huge. Pamela Payne, Los Angeles, California.
We bail you out with our hard-earned money. You still treat us like crap. This is Lester Begay from Burnham, New Mexico.
Charging increased fees to families who are out of work because they are not receiving direct deposits or other requirements of free checking or savings accounts is a morally corrupt practice. When people are hurting the most is when you gouge them with the most fees. I would like to see everyone in America remove their accounts from the big national banks. Perhaps when you don't have the 99% to prey on, you will realize just how important we are to your own livelihoods. Janelle Haynes in Syracuse, New York.
To Edith W. Cooper, Goldman Sachs. Greetings, Edith. I hope this message finds you well. Gosh, I'm thrilled to meet you, even though we haven't met face to face. Oh, wait, you haven't heard about our foreclosure. Law enforcement came to our door and gave us 1 hour to vacate. Oh, that morning was so much fun. I wish you could have been there. Our lender told us, don't worry, we want to work with you. We can see you've never been in trouble before, and, well, it's a long story. I'll save the rest of the story for next time because I am so looking forward to writing back again very, very soon. Your new pen pal, Hillary Grant in Los Osos, California.
I'm not fringe. I'm just mad as hell. Eileen S., New York City.
All right, short and sweet there. All of those letters from the book, The Trouble is the Banks, and its author, Mark Greif, joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So these really run the gamut of anger at the banks. You have some sarcasm in there, folks feeling like they've been ripped off, and these are pretty common responses in the letters that you have there.
Yeah, I think a lot of the letters are angry, and for good reason. But at the same time, a lot of them tend to, I don't know, I suppose they're compassionate or they speak of kindness. There are other letters that have a quality of peace to them.
Is there a letter that really sticks out to you or a sentiment that was expressed here?
I think for me, the ones that stand out are from people who lost their houses and speak about them, you know, not as numbers or dollars or contracts, but as places that they worked on, letters that say things like, my house doesn't look as good as it used to since you've been taking care of it or since you foreclosed on it.
So the house has been taken over by the bank and perhaps the lawn is not mowed, et cetera.
It sure seems that way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny when people begin talking about their neighbors, the towns they're in. You're reminded that these houses that we think of as just property or, you know, mortgages, pieces of paper, every one of them represents some place with flowers out front and, you know, vinyl siding or carpentry work that the owners had done themselves. Part of the power of the letters for me is that they make things specific and real that otherwise seem, you know, notional.
You went through 8,000 letters. First of all, how did you get them? And second of all, how do you curate that amount of material?
Well, you know, the book really started with a website, and it wasn't me. There was a website called Occupy the Boardroom, which was put together by people who had met in Zuccotti Park.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw the people who could come down to Zuccotti Park and speak about debt and foreclosure and rules for banks. But they also thought that there were so many people in the country who could never come or would never come to Zuccotti Park or to any part of Occupy. And they thought, well, we live in an age of email. Couldn't we have them write letters and actually get them to the executives and directors of banks? It made me think that we had to find a way to get the letters from the website and see if they could go out into the world in other ways.
So out of those 8,000, how many are in the book?
Between 100 and 200.
Wow.
What we did is we did read all 8,000. I worked with a whole team of people, volunteers, and many of them especially felt we had to read everyone. And from that, we picked about 200 and then contacted people to see if they gave us permission, if they wanted to be a part of a book. And from that, I think the best ones are left.
Knowing what the Occupy movement said it wanted and what has actually been achieved now, a year later, would you say it was successful?
I ask myself the question of Occupy success a lot, and I think the answer is paradoxical, because almost every one of the things that people demanded or imagined did not come fully to pass. The parks did not survive. It wasn't possible to, you know, to get movement to overrule Citizens United with a constitutional amendment. But I think people have felt emboldened by the presence of people willing to go outside, stand in the rain, sit on pavements, be pushed around, because they really believe that, in fact, banks need to be brought back under the rule of law, and that there are kind of inequalities of who pays taxes and who doesn't, a demand for fairness in America that's not being represented by either political party.
Mark Greif is a professor of American literature at the New School in New York City. The new book is called The Trouble is the Banks.
And now that we've
Thanks
heard
so
from
people involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement, let's address that question of what they accomplished. David Mayer teaches sociology at the University of California at Irvine, and he has spent a lot of time studying social movements. David, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
When you look at Occupy Wall Street compared to other social movements, how does this compare?
Well, the initial explosion of Occupy Wall Street was incredible, because there was this huge spread of activism across the country, and it was not gentle activism. It was visible, it was vigorous, and it was very disruptive. Usually, people have been organizing for years and years and years and years to have a sudden eruption of activism. And that was not visible for Occupy Wall Street. So that was a big deal.
But when we look back, what did the movement accomplish?
What the movement did was pull the debate back a little bit to the left. Suddenly, jobs and equality, political and economic equality, were part of the discussion.
But what, if anything, actually changed?
In terms of policy, nothing yet.
Right.
In terms of rhetoric, a lot. The terms of this election are different than they would have been without Occupy Wall Street.
When history looks back, I wonder if it will be easier to see the impact of the Tea Party versus the impact of the Occupy movement.
What we can absolutely trace now is a change in rhetoric and a change in mobilization.
But rhetoric doesn't help people.
Rhetoric doesn't help people directly. And changing the debate is only the first step in changing policy. Mm-hmm. So before President Lyndon Johnson pushed for the Voting Rights Act, he started adopting the civil rights movement language. He said, we shall overcome. Mm-hmm. He talked about providing civil rights. Rhetoric is a push. And it's certainly not enough. And then there's a question about influence. The Tea Party worked through mainstream politics, elected candidates, created a caucus in the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, yet they're now faced with a presidential candidate that every single Tea Partier in the United States, I'll say that boldly, finds a disappointment, but still better than President Obama. They find their politics redefined to the old social conservative coalition, which was not the original Tea Party. So they got co-opted and they didn't get all they wanted. Occupy worked really, really hard to avoid that, to stay grassroots, to not cut deals. And they may have fallen off the side and may have dissipated. And at this moment, it looks like you can tell a story where either strategy to influence carries huge possible pitfalls.
Well, you know, we can talk about what we from the outside see as what happened to the Occupy movement. But I wonder, do you think that they feel that that movement feels like it achieved the goals it set out to accomplish?
I think activists are the last people who recognize the influence they've had. When I've interviewed activists, they always think, about the deficiencies. When people go out in the streets, they have bold imaginations, mm-hmm. and they have broad goals. When I interview anti-war activists, the ones I talk to think that their efforts were for naught. But President Nixon ended the draft in response to the anti-war activists. Now, was that enough? Was that all they asked for? No. And then, you know, these movements are broad coalitions with people who want lots of different things. And most of those people are going to go home and remember the thing that they didn't get that they advocated for.
Not everybody, in fact, a very, very, very infinitesimal percentage of the population actually went out into the streets. So what does that tell us about the passion for this movement?
Most people are not taking to the streets under any circumstances. One of the really smart things for any social movement to do, any organization to do, is to give people a range of things to do in support of the movement's goals. Actually, the Tea Party was pretty good about that, because people who didn't go to demonstrations could go to community meetings, and people who didn't go to community meetings could write checks, and people who didn't write checks could at least vote. Occupy didn't provide that staircase or that ladder of political options that other movements have provided. And that's a challenge for the people who support Occupy.
Is it possible to say at this point, or is it too early, only a year into its history, where the Occupy movement fits in the pantheon of social movements?
I think it's way too early. I think the big blast in 2011 was an extraordinary departure from most history of American social movements in its rapid emergence. It's not clear whether the rapid decline will also be legendary and anomalous in the history of American social movements. The Tea Party built institutions. 5 years from now, you'll look through the phone book in Washington, D.C., and you'll find some group with Tea Party in its name, and somebody's going to answer that phone. And it's not clear whether Occupy is going to generate something comparable.
David Meyer is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Irvine and also the author, most recently, of The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.